You're listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast with your hosts, Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to this week's Soccer Report Extra podcast. I'm Bobby McMahon, alongside me is Owen O'Callaghan, and at the controls we have producer Luke Crawford. This week we look at European qualifiers, playoffs, USA versus France, England versus Spain in two friendlies, give a nod to World Cup qualifiers, and we start off with not Ireland. We'll go through the other ones. We'll go through the supporting cast first, and then we'll get to your main event.
Sounds good.
One game really sitting in the balance, Bosnia-Portugal.
We were talking about Portugal.
Yes.
On the Fox Soccer Report on Friday. And they came out and they certainly didn't disappoint our predictions, did they? Blaming the pitch.
Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't good enough.
Hurt both teams, I thought.
Yeah. Portugal seemed to be the most likely to break the deadlock.
Yeah.
But clear-cut chances were few and far between, if memory serves me correctly.
They seem to put on their boots with the slices on the side.
Ronaldo, in particular, had one that veered about, you know, 30 kilometres left of where he wanted to actually to hit.
Poor game. Poor spectacle.
Pepe, once again, marshalling Edin Dzeko.
What a pairing. Pepe and Bruno Alves. Have you ever come across a more agricultural pair of centre-backs? This side of England.
I wonder how many commentators have used in describing them the uncompromising central defensive duo.
Rugged.
Yes.
Blacksmiths.
Yeah, pretty much. But Edin Dzeko, kind of, again, marginalised. We spoke about the importance of his teammates kind of stepping up if he was finding it difficult to get into the game. But they just never really made any.
Bisevic came on. He missed a couple of sitters. Mm. Pjanic was very quiet.
Yeah.
It was, I don't think we've got much to say about it, actually, do we?
Well, back to Portugal for the second leg.
I think Bosnia still got didn't concede an away goal. So they get one. Portugal got scored two. This one, I would say, still in the balance. Very much in the balance.
And this kind of sideshow, maybe? Portuguese international football continues for the moment. I mean, even with Paulo Bento as coach, it was a spectacle with Carlos Queiroz in charge to begin with. But Bento's come in and there's been just moments where...
I think Portugal really stand out in my mind as a team that lacks variety. They have a lot of players that look very much the same. And then they miss that, certainly up front, they miss a striker. Paleto used to get them to the finals and then used to struggle to score.
Failed to turn up in the
finals.
But
he used to at least get them there. He used to score a lot of goals in the qualifier, but they still have this problem of who is actually going to play that position.
Yeah, I always remember when I watched Portugal in the mid-90s that even though Paleto would be up front, he wasn't a conventional striker. He'd always drop deeper, and I'm just... in the moment, thinking of how it was a bit
before that, it was kind of Nuno Gomes, wasn't it?
Yeah,
he did England in 2000 and the European Championships, and then Paleta came. All he kind of drifted a little bit, but he always seemed to do a pretty good job of getting in the box at the right time.
Yeah,
and doing the job. So Portugal still have that problem. Bosnia still in wish out, which is more than you can say for Turkey.
Oh God,
were they carved or stuffed?
Hey, turkey puns. It's good to be back on the podcast, that's for sure. We just want Luke to go over to the drum and do the little, but he's declined. Again, I was anticipating this game to be, it's going to be hell for leather.
2 minutes!
Yeah, Gus Hiddink and Slaven Bilic going on it again.
So much for my faith in Gus Hiddink.
It was just a collapse, wasn't it?
It was terrible. Defensively, I thought Bilic totally outcoached him.
Really?
In terms of their approach, yeah. You look at some of the numbers. I don't know if I've got the numbers here handled. Maybe I do. I managed to bring some stuff with me. Let me just...
some stuff, he says.
Some stuff. Because I'm well prepared.
And clearly, I'm not.
Could maybe work for RTE one day. Turkey. Let's look at total passes. 614 passes for Turkey.
Really?
Yeah. 83.6% success rate. Croatia, 249 passes.
That is phenomenal.
65% accuracy, which is down there. That is poor.
Yeah.
Possession, Let's just look at overall. There's a little bit of a difference first half, second half, but Turkey dominated both. 71.2% for Turkey, 28.8% for Croatia.
So Turkey had all of the ball.
Yeah.
And
passed it well.
Passed it very well.
Or accurately.
But just...
And got stuffed 3-0. Because they basically had the ball and they couldn't do anything with it when it got into the key areas.
No creativity. None. No urgency.
No. No. The trouble moving the ball out from the back when they did get it in the midfield. And then they moved it around and they looked kind of like Arsenal a couple of seasons ago in their worst days. Mm. Just square, square, square. And really couldn't unlock Croatia.
Where does Gus Hiddink go now?
Oh, Chelsea aren't in trouble, are they? No, can't say Chelsea.
Because
who's in trouble?
Where,
actually, the word is probably Ajax.
Really?
Yeah, that's a rumour. That's the one I see the most, as director of football at Ajax. Cruyff is still seems to be embroiled in a little bit of a battle in the boardroom at Ajax, but Gus Hiddink as director of football is something that's come up a number of times on in the internet and webcast and...
I'm thinking if
various publications.
I'm thinking for World Cup qualifying. Is there a sleeping giant in need of an injection of a bit of Gus Hiddink?
United States.
Oh, oh,
he's a foreign coach.
He is foreign. He's Dutch. Total football.
Oh, must be total football. Yeah, can't be anything but.
Hang on a
second. We'll get to that later. But no, the luster between that and the you can't say Turkey are out yet, but it's. Pretty much. If it's not Mission Impossible, it's Mission Nigh Impossible.
Croatia lose a 3-goal lead.
Yeah, they just as I say, Bilic just totally outplayed or outthought Hiddink in terms of found the weaknesses in the Turkish team and made sure that they were forced to play at them.
Well, this was kind of Slaven Bilic drinking in the last chance saloon a little bit.
It was a little bit of vindication for Bilic's. Reinvigorated his career here because now, of course, you get into this situation, and this is going to be, I think, a pattern through this podcast. Of we've got to be very careful; we don't project one-off performances over future, because playing a counter-attacking game away from home and winning 3-0 is one thing, but doing it when you've got to win a game in the European Championships is something completely different.
Mm. He's got good experience in the Euros. Obviously, you go back to 2008 when he, you know, made his grand introduction to the world from a managerial perspective, and had a lot of Premier League clubs coming after him, asking whether or not he wanted to move into English football as a coach. So he'll get another chance to sit in on an international tournament and hopefully impress a few people once again.
Then he can go to West Ham.
That's the dream partnership, isn't it?
We'll finish off with just one more stat, just picking up from the Croatia-Turkey game. Attempts on goal. You want to have a guess?
Wow me.
I'm going to wow you. Croatia, 16 attempts on goal. Turkey, 2. Shots on target, Croatia, 7. Turkey, bugger all. That is pretty tame. Croatia, shots, just finish off with this one. Shots inside the box, 10 for Croatia. That is incredible, isn't it? With so little possession, so little ability, supposedly, to one out of three passes going astray, and you come up with
shooting on sight.
A 3-0 win and these attempts and goals. It's phenomenal. Phenomenal. Anyway, so that one, and so the other one. Czechs, do you think the Czechs are through, or that one still hold that one abeyance a little bit?
I think the Czechs are through, mainly because in that first leg, Montenegro's inexperience.
Montenegro have got to come out and score some goals now, don't they? And that's going to leave themselves open. Rosicki having a good game. I didn't see the game, but I'm just going by hearsay here.
He set up the second goal from a free kick.
Yeah.
But the first goal was an absolute belter, about 25 yards.
The second goal was a late goal, I believe, wasn't it? Coming in injury time?
Yes.
I think I've got that one someplace.
Off the top of my head. But, the second goal, which was clearly the clincher for the tie.
Yeah.
Probably the clincher for the tie. It came from a free kick.
92nd minute.
92nd.
Yeah, defender that scored Civic.
The one thing that you would have wanted from the Montenegrins is, okay, a 1-0 defeat we can deal with.
It's looking not bad, is it? You feel you've got a little bit of confidence here. Get one goal back.
That's it.
You're right back in the game. Yeah, right back in the tie.
Rosicki had a free kick from the left-hand side, which he swung in with his right foot. And suddenly, there was just acres of space. It was just the Montenegro, they just completely switched off. Again, maybe it's a lack of leadership, lack of guidance. Just to stay tight, stay focused, and in that moment, you may have seen them just completely eliminated now.
Yeah,
which is, but you know, then again, maybe you have to go through it. You know, experiences like that in order to be there next time.
Somebody said at the beginning this qualification to Montenegro get the playoffs, even going out, be a massive achievement for them. So you look at where they are, they almost made the first group of seeds in the European qualifying for World Cup.
That's true.
They were very close. So they've made incredible progress. And you look at how the Balkans region have produced players over decades and decades and decades. There's no indication that Montenegro will be a country that will be taking a step backwards in the next little while.
No, certainly not. I think that they had a change of manager, with whatever it was, two qualifiers to go.
Yeah, Krankjær got fired.
Berkovic was brought in, and you know, you saw how tight they were as a defensive unit before the change in coach. And you know, with the goals that they conceded, particularly that second one, I'm just isolating that moment, but I think it was a snapshot. Of just what they need to improve on. But you know, maybe it was just a little bit of naivety on their behalf. But certainly, I mean, 2-0 down, granted you can't completely rule them out of a comeback.
The bottom line is you can't afford to concede that goal.
No.
You concede that goal, you've got to win 4-1 at that point, and that is asking an incredible amount of Montenegro.
So the thing is as well, the Czechs, this will be their fifth successive European championships.
Going back to 96, I guess.
96, I think, yeah.
2000, they were drawn in the group of death. That was the France and, who was it, France and Netherlands they were in with, I think.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken in that one. And Netherlands got the semi-final.
Was it France got the final? France, Holland and Italy in the same group.
No, you're thinking another one. You're thinking of 2008.
Yeah, sorry.
And then 2004 was Portugal, where the Czechs went to the semi-final, lost to the Greeks.
Greeks.
Yes, that was the semi-final upset.
Yeah,
and then there was a lot of upsets in that one. And then what did the Czechs do in 2006? Can't really remember much about them in 2006. Yeah. Couldn't have been much then.
No. But, you know, it's interesting that...
Sorry, 2008.
2008.
Yeah.
Still have that, you know, you talk about the age profile of that team. I think it's 29.
It's one of the older teams, that's
as the
sure.
average age. Obviously, their lineup changes sometimes from game to game, but they're still there. Next summer, they're going to be at another international tournament. They're going to keep that, whatever it is, second seed place, I would imagine.
Well, you look at, you got Juracek, you got Plasil. Plasil's got to be 31 now, but I always thought he's a kind of decent player to have in your team. Kadlec, I guess, is a connection.
Like, Kalic is a decent player.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because you go back to 96, it was his dad that was playing the same position at that time.
You're scoring goals from penalties. You're making me feel old.
Isn't that something, eh? And he's taking the penalties for the Czech Republic as well now, and of course you've got Peter Cech. So they've moved players around. I guess Rosicky is one that picked it up. We're not talking about him being 96. We're talking about that 96 team being the Nedved team.
Poborski, yeah. Infamous scooped goal.
I've gone blank on him.
Jan Koller
up front. But played for Liverpool and then went to Aston Villa. Left-footed player.
But Vladimir Smicer was another one of that team.
On the tip of my tongue.
Patrick Berger,
exactly.
There you go.
When a player, there's a player. If he was fit, as good as any in the world on his day.
Had a left foot that could open a can of beans.
Yeah, he's a cracker, but God, was he injury prone, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was unfortunate.
I think it was just that, you know, the Premier League didn't really see the best of him.
No.
He had his moments, obviously, and could crack a shot from distance.
Great, great shot. Anyway, so this all leads up to Estonia 0, Ireland 4.
Mm-hmm.
Trapattoni, may I quote here? Can I quote Trapattoni?
Please do.
Can I quote the great Trap? I am not God. Did we know that? I can see how you could be mistaken for God.
Well, the thing is that if you ask the...
And maybe I don't speak English very well. Or Italian too good. No, I added that. But I've been in football for many years and I understand this. I thought that Walter showed his qualities. We got that right. I think the we is us and him.
I think he watched this show on Friday.
And listened to the podcast.
I think so.
That's probably where he gets his English from.
Good grief. Actually, that would explain a lot.
The puzzle has been solved.
Yeah, Trapp's pre-game press conferences normally kind of rotate around him saying stuff like, we first half, bang, hit them good midfield ball, Walters, Keane, ball, goal, win, bang. That's pretty much what he says.
So that's probably the connection with God, right? The Big Bang Theory.
There you go. He does that a lot and has sound effects and stuff. And it's always interesting.
So did I ever tell you that I saw Trapattoni play?
Ooh. 70s?
60s.
Really?
Yeah, he played in the Milan team with Maldini's dad, Cesare Maldini. And there's Jose Altafini, the team that won in 63.
When did you see them, though?
Against Dundee, semi-final. 1962-63 European Cup.
You were only a whippersnapper.
I was quite young, but I remember it because Trapattoni man-marked Alan Gulzin in the second leg at Dens.
How did he man-mark him? Was he tight? Was he uncompromising?
He was a very uncompromising kind of player, Trapattoni. He came with a bit of a reputation. He was quite young. He must have been, guessing he's probably
quite
only
slender.
21, 22, kind of blonde. He still is that kind
still
of
is,
blonde,
yeah.
But man-marked Gulzin, even though they led 5-1, they still man-marked Gulzin. Gulzin got sent off for laying one on.
Really?
not Trapattoni, there was somebody else, if I remember rightly. But yeah, he got sent off. But yeah, I remember Trapattoni from 63, and they went on to win. They went beat Benfica in the final 2-1. Altafini scored a couple. Mm. And yeah, it was an interesting team.
Trapattoni, I'm kind of delighted for him because he's coming for a lot of stick.
Never really done at international level. You look at his history, tremendous record at domestic competition in Italy, but also in Germany as well.
Yeah.
And he was someplace else.
He was at Salzburg.
Yeah, he's really, he just obviously loves the game. Either that or he's got to work because he needs some money.
He's got a couple of houses around the world.
But his success or lack of success with Italy in 2002 kind of sticks out with Korea. But even internationally, at the club level, he's got a European Cup in there with Juventus
litany of Scudetto.
That's a Heysel, wasn't it? Trapattoni was a Heysel the game. And I think he's got a Cup Winners' Cup in there and maybe a UEFA Cup. But domestic competition has really been his strength. So this is giving him another bite at the international competition cherry, and something he's not been particularly successful with.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a lot of critics because of the style.
Were you one of them?
No.
No.
I think that you have to look at this in the big picture, and of course every team wants to play a counter-attacking, free-flowing style. But when you look at the Irish team, you look at their starting 11, look at Robbie Keane playing for the LA Galaxy. Before that, he was a reserve at Spurs. Up front with Kevin Doyle, who plays for Wolves, a midfield of Glenn Whelan from Stoke, and Keith Andrews on loan at Ipswich and Blackburn. You go through at McGeady at Spartak Moscow, Duff at Fulham. These guys are not world beaters.
Yeah.
And it's a far cry from having the likes of Houghton and McGrath.
Cascarino.
And, you know, guys like Aldridge, Quinn.
Yeah.
You know, you go through them, Dennis Irwin, Roy Keane, who were at
the
top teams in England at the time. It's an older team. You've got veterans like Given and Richard Dunne and Robbie Keane as well. Duff, of course. John O'Shea. So to get this team to a major international tournament, given the circumstances, it's a terrific achievement. I mean, these guys, you know, when Trapattoni came in, he also had to make a couple of big calls. Not playing a creative central midfielder. Lots of cries for Andy Reid at the time to be brought back into the international fold. Andy Reid fell out with Trapattoni for a late night drunken guitar playing after an away
Andy,
trip.
But Andy Reid, you've got to think, you know, to be fair, you get two things with Andy Reid. You get his ability on the ball, which is a good thing, but you also get somebody who could roll the pitch after.
Yeah. I mean, his fitness was always in question. His consistency was always in question. And Trapattoni,
he just doesn't work hard enough, does he?
And you said it yourself, Trapattoni comes from a background where there's a strong work ethic.
Yeah.
And you look at his types of his teams that he picks, there's a reason why in the central midfield you've got Glenn Whelan and Keith Andrews. People crying out for even Keith Fahey to be played.
To be a creative force.
To be basically a little bit more creative on the ball than Andrews or Whelan are.
Yeah.
But Trapattoni knows what he likes.
But he did play Jonathan Walters.
He played Walters ahead of Simon Cox this time. And Walters, I think, is just a really, really, you know, he's a guy that flies under the radar a little bit.
I would consider him a clever player.
Yes. I think you're a big fan of guys who know their limitations and they don't try to reinvent the wheel. Walters is big physically. He can do it, but he's got a good...
He's got a head on him.
He's got a head in him and he's got good pace as well, yeah, when he wants to. Knows when to lay it off, knows when to play a pass. And he's just a really consistent guy. You see it for Stoke at his at club level. But for the likes of Glenn Whelan, for the likes of Keith Andrews, a lot of people have been saying, oh, they're not international players. Yeah.
We've seen in past tournaments with past teams, you don't have to be international players. You have to be well organised. You have to have a little bit of luck along the way.
Yep.
And if these two things come into play at the right time and a little bit of inspiration, you can go... You know, I think we can get pulled into this. Remember Greece 2004 and say, look, you know, they can win it. And I think that you've got to position that the Greece thing as being an exception. They went on to win it, but most of the teams that catch that lightning in the bottle do not go on to win these competitions. Yeah. But they do go on to make an impact on the competition. You go back. I think, you know, one of the pieces I read on the weekend was a comparison to this Irish team in terms of feel to the 88 team.
Yeah. That's
going back after 10 years to a major tournament. In fact, 88 was the first one, but 10 years, that's a generation of players.
Oh,
and Damien Duff must be about the only one that's still around.
Was
Given 2002?
Given and Robbie were still there.
Yeah.
I mean, Duff and Keane both scored at that World Cup. Yeah. Given goes back further. Given was involved with the playoff for the 98 World Cup against Belgium, which was 97.
Okay.
So, I mean, Given has served his time.
Yeah, go back to Blackburn with Given, don't you?
Yeah. And
he was with the Blackburn team.
Celtic as well.
With
Tim Flowers.
Kenny Dalglish, and went to Newcastle after that.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you look back in international career, you've got one World Cup appearance to your name.
Yeah.
That's very disappointing. I mean, you've also got... I mean, Kilbane is still part
would
of the squad.
Would it upset me? I remember watching a lot more than that.
The thing is as well that Ireland have only ever appeared at one European Championships, which was 1988. So the record in this tournament is dismal.
Yeah.
You look at it that with this Trapattoni side, when it's grinding out results in a group stage format. I mean, people are talking about Ireland are going to go to European Championships next summer and be whipping boys. They're incredibly difficult to beat.
Yeah.
They're not very, very easy to just push over.
You look at the record, that one loss against Russia at home.
At home.
They're on a good run just now. They're not conceding goals. How much is down to Trapattoni and how much is down to Marco Tardelli?
I think the dynamic is just a really positive one. I think you saw in the World Cup qualifying for last summer, Liam Brady was also involved. And, you know, so... You get Brady, Tardelli and Trapattoni in a room and you still have people going, these guys don't know what they're doing. Like, before these guys, we had Steve Staunton in charge.
That must have been the most bizarre international appointment I can probably ever remember.
What people should do...
Apart from Kevin Keegan.
If you've got... what people should do if you've got a couple of minutes on our hands, there's a YouTube sketch when Peter Kenyon was still chief executive of Chelsea. And the Chelsea job was open. One of the radio stations in Dublin had a guy who phoned up Chelsea posing as Stephen Staunton and gets passed through to Peter Kenyon. At the end, he's talking to Peter Kenyon in that thick, horrible Drogheda brogue. And he's asking about the salary expectations and stuff. And Kenyon is just going, who is this? But it just encapsulates exactly what Steve Staunton was. It was a bizarre, short-lived, just ill-fated tenure. Before that, Brian Kerr, who you could argue was a bit unlucky.
He just resigned from Faroe Islands a couple of weeks ago, I noticed.
With people attaching his name to the Northern Ireland job.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure kind of works, but we'll see how that goes. But yes... he's been vindicated. Guys back home, pundits like Eamon Dunphy, John Giles, who, you know, we should be playing a possession-based game, you know, where we can put our foot in the ball, Bill. This is disgusting. This guy's a charlatan, he's cheap, he's Italian, it's about 1-0 wins. And you're like, he's getting us to a European Championship. Last year, he got us within one handball of perhaps playing at a World Cup. So when he has his job description in front of him, and when it comes to renegotiating contract, he's going to go, I got you to playoffs for World Cup, and I've got you to European Championships. I cannot do better than that. With these players, with the ability level that they have, this is a terrific job.
And it's not to to underplay the significance of the cash injection that that'll bring to the Irish Football Association, as these big tournaments always do to whoever qualifies.
And for the country in general, to have your soccer team go off to a major international tournament is a feel-good story, and the country economically crippled at the moment. So it's a bright spark, as 1988 was, you know, and 1990 was, when the country was going through a lot of turmoil, and it made people feel proud to be Irish again and proud of their nation again. And it's great. I mean, yeah, you got lucky. You had a 0-0 draw in Russia when Russia just absolutely
pelted them.
Yeah, it was just relentless. Richard Dunn was just standing there. I think, but it looked as if he'd gone, you know, 12 rounds with Ali in his prime. Just like bemused look on his face at full time, saying, "What we got over here with a point?" There were disappointing moments with the draw at home to Slovakia. So there are moments when you want a little bit more. But
you also look at that Slovakia draw and you go, that turned out to be a decent result, didn't it?
You look at the 1-0 win on the opening day against Armenia. Yeah. Everyone's saying, only a 1-0 win against Armenia? Who are they? And, you know, they were proven to be a decent football side. And, you know, we've got there, and it's good. There's a lot of cynics still. There's a lot of people who think that, you know, we're going to go and get our asses handed to us, you know, in Poland and Ukraine next summer.
It just doesn't happen anymore.
It won't happen.
Not that level. Not that level in terms of international competition.
You know what? We've seen it before, that, you know, the European Championships, it's a quarter-final place straight away. There's not, you don't have that round of 16. I would not put it past this group of Irish players to get through to a quarter-final place.
Well, can't see Estonia, certainly can't see Estonia come back from 4-0 down.
Dear.
Two players sent off, so all sorts of problems. So the next thing for Ireland, really, to finish the job off on Tuesday and then wait for the draw.
That's
which,
it.
It's coming up soon. But just finish off with a start and a nod to Robbie Keane here. Goal scorers, highest ever goal scorers in European qualification, European Championship qualification. 19, Hakan Şükür and John Dahl Thomason, Turkey and Denmark respectively.
Yep.
And 18, Robbie Keane, Jan Koller and Raoul. Not bad company.
He's in good company.
Yeah.
I would like to know from those 18 goals how many were penalties and how many were tap-ins from 6 yards.
I'll manage to get that for you later.
But credit where it's due. The guy has an astonishing international goal scoring record.
He does. He's about one every two, isn't he? Maybe even better than that.
And his ability to just kind of pick up braces here and there as well.
There are players that just excel at international football.
He's had a tough time, Robbie. I don't think he's ever fully been accepted by the media. I think there is, you know, when he came on the scene, he's a bit like Michael Owen, you know. He's this kid.
Oh, very similar.
You know, just could jet off. You know, I remember his debut against Argentina. I've talked about it on this pod before, where he just had, you know, like always on his heels, always moving. He was just something that we had never seen before. And then as the player matures, his game matures. So you don't get this. It's like Wayne Rooney. You don't get the same moments of magic and volleys from 35 yards that you did when the kid was 17 years old. So, you know, he's obviously had his problems at domestic level. People were thinking that's internationally he just wasn't bringing his same sort of consistent performances. And now with his move to MLS, that was also a lot of people thought it was the wrong move, and maybe it'd have a negative effect. I think it has had a negative effect on his performances at international level. But he keeps scoring. So he can just turn around to me and say, well, what do you know? I'm still putting the ball on the back of the net.
Did again. Got to remember, from Los Angeles Galaxy's point of view, they're going to lose a player for next summer.
Exactly.
For a good part of next summer. So that wraps up European qualifying. We'll, by tomorrow night, I guess we'll pretty much know, I think, at least two of the teams, probably a third one, with one still really sitting in the balance. Quick nod to World Cup qualifying before we go, move on to the friendlies. CONCACAF, Canada through. Talking about results, they got the result. Not great performance. Pretty ropey game. Didn't see much there. But they're through. They play, and they've now joined a group with Honduras, Cuba, and Panama. That's not going to be easy.
We were talking about the permutations of these groups before. And, I mean, when you're looking at scoreless draw at home to St. Kitts, Yeah.
Well, that was away then, the play at home against Toronto. They're in Toronto on Tuesday.
Oh, sorry. So that was away
but
from home.
To be honest, they drew nothing with Puerto Rico. So two consecutive nothing draws, one at home, one away, is not great.
It's. You, no.
But what, it's the result. They got the result. They didn't concede a goal.
At this stage.
So try and look at the positive for
Yeah, well, at this stage, it's all about preparation, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, for the what's to come next. I mean, as you said, Panama, Honduras, and Cuba.
I think Panama and Honduras would be the teams. I don't rate Cuba all that highly, but I think Panama could be a real stumbling block there. El Salvador goes through. That was pretty much set before the weekend, but they confirmed that. Joined Mexico, Costa Rica, and one of the surprises, Guyana, who knocked out Trinidad and Tobago. That was a surprise.
Huge.
Mm-hmm. So, further bad news on the top of the jug. Warner problems in Trinidad and Tobago go with the 2-1 loss. Panama, we talked about already. They're already qualified. Guatemala joins Jamaica, US. And the other surprise entry into the next stage of CONCACAF World Cup qualifying, Antigua and Barbuda.
Fair play to them.
Yes.
Hats off to Antigua
and Barbuda.
Was Barbuda
not in the Pirates of the Caribbean?
Careful now that you don't take the piss out of another country. Because we got in trouble before.
But they beat Haiti 1-0.
That's a pretty astonishing.
Yeah. As I was listening to the US, the coverage in Canada anyway, the US France game, and I don't know who the commentator was. But apparently Antigua and Barbuda beat not Haiti but Haiti.
Oh, Haiti. Yeah,
it was one of these many really strange pronunciations. Now, I shouldn't be talking about anybody's pronunciation, but he managed to hit some crackers.
Does that mean we're going to talk about US-France now?
I think that would be a segue, wouldn't it?
It would be nice.
Yes, so let's move on to one of the World Cup qualifiers, one of the friendlies, I should say, that took USA to Paris.
Saint-Denis.
An American in Paris. Actually, a whole bunch of Americans in Paris. Oh, I thought he was going to have the George Gershwin song ready to go.
Bit of Gene Kelly.
God, it's so hard to get good help, isn't it?
I know, terrible. You want one step ahead of us, Luke.
You saw it coming a mile away.
Oh, I did.
We telegraphed it.
Beautiful balletic sequence in that movie. Amazing, if we can get that music.
He says he'll add it in post, for those who didn't hear. Anyway, US, moving on to this game. USA, France. Jurgen Klinsmann his statistics are becoming a little bit like Arsenal have not won a trophy since 2005. You would think it was all part of his name. Jurgen Klinsmann, who has only one win in 6 games. Okay, let's go.
2 goals, 6 games.
It was interesting, the number of comparisons, and begin to see little pieces entering into comments about a very Bradley-like performance.
Interesting you should bring up Arsenal, because Arsene Wenger joined the US team after the game in the dressing room.
Did he?
To discuss their performance.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
What did he have to say?
I have no idea.
He did not see the incident.
It was not quality.
But France, I thought the game a little bit cagey in the first half. France had the best of it, but second half was something very different.
Very horrible to watch if you were Grinsey Clinsey on the sidelines there. It was relentless, unfortunately, for the US. It was just as if they couldn't catch their breath and didn't have time to properly set themselves up, because it was just attack after attack after attack.
There was one sequence between about the 54th and 56th minute where there was 3 separate incidents, and there could have been easily 3 goals. One of them involved 2 blocks and a shot wide, and that was all within like 10 to 15 seconds of each other.
Yeah,
they were just under the cosh.
Yeah,
and in the end it wasn't a 1-0 game, really.
Oh,
was it?
No, I mean, Benzema hit the bar with a header from a free kick, just got a little flick on it. He was practically under the bar when he headed it, which made the chance a little bit more difficult. Then he had a free kick that Howard clawed away from his near post, very closely being over the line. I think Howard just got his one hand to it, just clawed it out. And then a ball player over the top for Remy, who had a shot, and then Olivier Giroud followed it up. I thought it was a penalty.
Yeah.
Howard came out with his feet.
I
went
thought the same thing.
Giroud.
I was really surprised there wasn't more talk about that. Yeah. But there again with a commentator that talked about Haiti.
The French central midfielder, was and then finally, when the goal did come, we had just seen it. It was the same ball over the top, using Remy's pace and movement, just kind of brushed off Clarence Goodson, and then just tucked it away, bottom corner, and that was it. And you have to say that France were a good value for a 1-0 lead, and it probably should have been. I mean, even if it was something like 3-0, you probably couldn't argue with it too much.
I think it was a tweet I put up, or maybe it was a blog, I can't remember some days. One or the other, but
they're all the same.
This comment about Parson and Alexi Lalas talked about the inexperienced French side.
Oh, come
and that
on.
America, the States should have gone after them. This isn't an inexperienced French side. Maybe there are some players making their international debut, but being inexperienced on the international stage in a friendly, does it really make that much difference compared with players that are playing in Ligue 1 and playing in European Championships, Champions League or Europa League every couple of weeks? We're talking about some pretty battle-hardened players here.
Yeah, and you I think it's a comment like that is just a little bit ignorant of the caliber of players.
But it's not just Alexi Lalas. It's something that just found its way right through the press.
Mm.
It's because Laurent Blanc said he was willing to experiment with some younger players. Mm. Suddenly that was going, oh, they're inexperienced.
Yeah.
Or some new players, oh, they're inexperienced.
Yeah.
No, they're not. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, when you had Benzema, Ribéry, Jeremy Menez, Hugo Lloris.
You go through, the team was a pretty good team. The substitute bench was a pretty strong bench.
The players, I suppose, what, in inverted commas, the lesser known players that were playing.
Just because they haven't heard of them.
Laurent Koscielny at centre back.
Yeah, just because they haven't heard of them doesn't mean they're inexperienced.
I mean, Yann M'Vie in centre midfield has been around that French team for over a year.
Is he a specimen?
He's a bit.
Wow, is he built.
Alongside him, who we all know.
Mathieu plays Valencia left back, left midfield. He's making his debut. God, he's played at least 2 years of Champions League. Not experienced.
Adil Rami, who's there, also been around that team for quite a while. Yeah. And then it's Kevin Gamero up front.
Yeah.
So I don't really understand how you the substitutes you bring on, Loic Remy. I mean, if you watch Champions League, you know how good these guys are.
This is a quote from a website or an article from a report. With his team already qualified for next summer's European Championships and coming off a 15-game streak with 11 wins and no losses, France manager Laurent Blanc played a squad composed largely of young, untested talent that nonetheless frequently outpaced the Americans.
I mean, sorry, but that's bullshit.
That
is bullshit.
Yeah.
And whoever wrote that, there's no research, there's no homework done. And as I said, it's ignorant to the players who are playing for France. Oh, you've been untested.
And it gives a misimpression of what the States are up against as well.
Yeah. I don't think, like, there's a perception that, I don't know, the US, everyone was thinking that US were going to go to Paris and come away with some sort of victory. I don't know. It's to go to Paris on any given occasion and come away with a positive result is incredibly difficult. France, who looked, to be honest, I think they looked impressive in Euro qualifying. They had their moments, but Blanc has a few dips
that you begin to raise the doubts again.
Yeah, but I think, you know, with Blanc there, I mean, it's he steadied the ship, and going by the ridiculousness that preceded him, it's calmer certainly. And I mean, the younger player, sorry, the untested players that he has at his disposal have certainly come up trumps for him. I mean, this is the future of the French international team. The likes of Yann M'Vie, Gamero, Benzema, obviously in the form of his life. Adil Rami, who I think is really good. And Debuchy, who had a great game at right back.
He was uncompromising.
He's a tough character, isn't he?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, he had one particularly with Timmy Chandler coming through in the first half. Just absolutely tattooed him.
Yeah, Timmy. Didn't stand a chance in that one.
But how do you assess this US performance?
They're
outclassed.
They're outclassed by a better team.
So who out there, just to pick up on a lot of the comments out there, who was missing? Who could they have brought in that would have made a difference to this team?
This is the biggest
Omar Gonzalez
concern. What are these guys going to do for you?
Yeah.
Sorry, I mean, not to be disrespectful to
but they wouldn't have changed the game, would it?
We went off camera on the Fox Soccer Report on Friday. We were talking about MLS, and we were talking about. I threw a question at you saying, "Listen, there's friendly games here for the US. Is there anyone from the MLS season just gone who Klinsmann may have looked at and went, that guy could possibly do a job for me?" And you kind of shrugged your shoulders and went, "Not really."
Yeah.
And that's just the truth of it. You cannot just go out and go, five players, brilliant, and just expect them to come in. It's like very similar to the Republic of Ireland problem. People want players to play a certain way and a certain style, but they're limited, and you have to respect their limitations. You cannot teach.
And that is the secret of a good manager, is understanding the limitations of a player and giving them a format and giving them giving them ways that they can succeed and giving things that they can achieve and make it difficult. That's what formations and tactics are about.
Yeah.
It's playing your strengths, mitigating your weaknesses, and trying to play other teams' weaknesses. Go back, said this at the beginning, and I know you've said this as well. Klinsmann is not going to be judged on this edition of the US national team.
No.
If Klinsmann succeeds, it's what it's going to be 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. Because there aren't players out there that he can bring in that are magically going to turn this team into a full-flowing, interesting, attractive team. If the US are going to have any success on the world stage, at some point, Klinsmann is going to have to, I just feel, is going to have to revert back to some form of Bob Bradley kind of approach to it.
It's, listen,
because the players just aren't there.
Granted, you've got the kind of, the focus, the spotlight that's been placed on Breck Shea as some sort of Messi-like figure who can turn it on. Oh,
Gareth Bale or Fernando Torres, according to an article I read.
Right. So that's fine, but Breck Shea ultimately is an MLS player. Right?
He's a big, strong player. He's got upside.
He's got upsides. He's got,
but he's not. Well. He's not the first player that we've seen with upside who failed to take the upside and finished up going back.
Exactly.
So we should be looking at Breck Shea being a work in progress. We should be asking the question, can he make that step up?
Yeah.
Not assuming he will make that step up.
Yeah. So when this article is written saying, Breck Shea disappoints against France, and that's a headline. Listen, for the country that produced Freddie Adu and everything that came along with that, let's give this guy a little bit of time to develop before we start screaming from the rooftops that he's the next Pele. But the there's a problem for Klinsmann in that the longer this goes on,
pressure begins to mount. You begin to see it turning already. You begin to see every game that goes by. He desperately needs a win against Slovenia. It doesn't matter if it's a great performance. He does need something.
And then
to tease the pressure a little bit.
The biggest thing is, and I've kind of raised this before, how you lose a kind of a Brian McBride type figure.
Yep.
That guy who's essentially a bit of a goal hanger. Just hanging in there, but he's consistent in just sticking his leg out, suddenly divert it to the bottom corner. Hey, a goal. Yeah. Terrific.
Now, which Jose Altidore has not been able to achieve yet.
Yeah, now, there's more to McBride's game, obviously. But Altidore coming in for a lot of praise for his performance in this game.
Thought he actually played reasonably well, considering he got absolutely zero support in the first half. Dempsey began to get a little bit closer to him in the second half.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's any coincidence that France began to dominate to an even greater extent in the second half.
Yeah.
Because United States started pushing a little bit further up the park in terms of Dempsey.
Yeah.
So left themselves a bit short-handed. The midfield, Shea didn't give much on the left. Williams didn't give much on the right. Morris Adu, I should say, is he's a defensive midfield player. He's either that or a centre-back, but he's certainly not something that's going to dictate a tempo of the game and manage the game very well.
Yeah.
Beckerman, I like Kyle Beckerman as a player. I think he's got a nice touch, but he lacks pace to play at the very top level. He's just going to get found out. So we're going to Slovenia. They need that. And World Cup qualifying is just around the corner. That's when it really begins. The rubber hits the road.
Well, is that enough, though? For instance, granted, because ultimately, right, it comes back to the Bradley discussion that we had.
Yeah.
That was it about results anymore? That the reasoning behind his sacking. So, if you go through World Cup qualifying and you get to the World Cup, well, you're the US. So, we expect you to get to the World Cup now. So does Klinsmann have other questions to answer?
Yes, I believe he does, because World Cup should be taken, I wouldn't say for granted, but it should be an accepted, an absolute minimum level of performance for the United States in terms of the resources, the league, the players that are available, et cetera, et cetera. The question is, when they get to Brazil, to be honest, the team they were in 2010, that team could still get to Brazil in 2014. The problem is you get to Brazil, it's not going to be good enough. It's not going to be nearly good enough, and I can guarantee they would be out. They'd be too old. They'd be going out in the first... They'd be home before the postcards. The question is, how does he now transition this team? And you see bits and pieces of it. And I perhaps sound like I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth here, but I don't think that anybody can criticise Klinsmann, who was pushing for Klinsmann to be appointed in the first place.
Sure.
If you're pushing for that appointment, you should be shutting up at the moment and saying, be patient. We've got to go the distance with him. And it's not judged after six. But anybody that writes a critical article, I believe, should come out and state their position of whether they believe Klinsmann is the right appointment to begin with. Because if you're saying he's the right appointment and criticise him after six games, you've got a distorted sense of values.
Yeah, and also I think it's like the Trapattoni situation a lot of times, is that it's very, very easy to be critical when things aren't going right. What I would say, though, is you look at that team that took on France with a view to World Cup and with a view to improving and getting better and being better than what Bradley could put together. Is there...
still a problem.
Centre-back.
Bocanegra, good game for probably about 60, 65 minutes. And then he began to fade. But he's not going to be around in 3 years' time, I don't think, to be an effective player.
Now, you've got that. So let's park that for 30 seconds, because left back...
Yeah.
Is Chandler... Or is that very much still up in the air?
Critics seem to be quite happy with him. I still think it's a major problem. Every time you play a right-footed player at left back, there's a potential for... potential unbalanced side. You have an unbalanced side. They've had an unbalanced side for a long time. They desperately need a fit and informed Marcus Beasley back.
It's interesting when we're talking about that. For an attacking team, the right channel, so between left back and the left-footed centre back, that three France chances were the long ball over the top into that zone.
Late on, I think that maybe runs into the conversation about Bocanegra maybe finding the pace beginning to get to him after a while. I don't think Clarence Goodson's the answer either. I really don't, but I don't know what the answer is there. But I don't think it's necessarily Omar Gonzalez. If they continue to push to play an entertaining, attractive style of football from the back, I don't think he's the answer either.
But what we are saying is that there is time to find alternatives.
There should be, because they still should be. If you look at that World Cup section that they're about to get undergoing, Jamaica, shouldn't be a problem.
No.
Really? I mean, I know Jamaica have made great progress, and they should be one of the two teams going through.
Yeah.
But I think Jamaica, I thought actually in the Gold Cup, were very much in the situation, kind of a Bradley situation. They've got a well organised team. They've put some real, they have a really good solid look about them, but they lack creativity and the lack of focus up front. And until they get that, they're going to be a team that's probably going to go so far and then they're going to top out. And I think, you know, I can see them getting to the hex. Can't see them getting any further than that, though.
And also, I mean, you mentioned in the Gold Cup, in that USA-Jamaica game, that there is only one team ever going to win that game.
Yep.
You know, so that there is that gulf in class.
Well,
that really
we finished up, there was a lot of, I think there was a lot of pumping up of Jamaica based on what they'd played against so far, as opposed to trying to rank that in some sort of equitable way and trying to say were they really as good as the United States. So, next part for the United States is after Slovenia on Tuesday. We'll, I guess, revisit this again at some point. But that takes us on the next game, the friendly, England and Spain, which is interesting because England beat the world champion Spain. How many people in England are sitting there criticising Fabio Capello for a very negative style of play? Don't see it. They're just happy they won. Capello did what he's supposed to do. Put out a team that made it difficult to beat. Did to Spain what Switzerland did. Did them what United States did a few years ago as well in Confederations Cup. Defended deep, stayed compact, well organised, took their chance when it came along.
Two things that bother me about this. One, the press reaction in England. Two,
that's unusual.
The press reaction in Spain. I was always under the impression that Spain have immersed themselves in gratitude because they're finally at the top of their game after so long failing to reach the dizzying heights of being winners in a tournament. Now they come out after they're beaten
at Wembley with stuff like, well, England weren't really playing football, were they? No, actually, it's about your team having a huge inability to break down a really well-drilled and really put-together defence that's set up in front of you and you had no answer to penetrating it.
One man's cowardice is another man's pragmatism.
It's pragmatism. It was great to watch for a start because it's that chess match, right? Some guy goes on the defensive and he's telling the other guy, come after me. Give me your best shot. And Spain had no answer to it. Villa hit the post. He seemed to be the greatest threat. They brought Fabregas on. He missed a couple of chances.
Really good ones.
And outside of that, Joe Hart wasn't tested at all. So I don't know how Spain can sit there and criticise England when they fail to create any real decent opportunities.
Without getting into the argument about whether you want to see attractive football from both teams or not, the way Capello had England engage Spain like 40 yards out, so you don't allow them get to 20 yards out and then start engaging them and making it difficult for them. They made them difficult 40 yards out. So Spain had to come through that first barrier.
Yep.
Then they got the next barrier. And then finally, there was the back four. And they just didn't get in behind. I know Stuart Robson on the commentary we got in Canada talked a lot about missing the kind of things that an informed Fernando Torres brings to the team. But I thought Pedro was a player they really missed. He's been suffering from an ankle injury lately. But that was the kind of game I thought Pedro would have made a massive difference to them in.
I thought there was... It's interesting how different things jump out to different people who are watching it. I thought that one thing became apparent in the Spanish fullbacks not getting forward. Or at least the Spanish fullbacks missing something that they've had before.
Well, it's Ramos moving to centre-back. Arbeloa coming in at right back. I guess Puyol was missing.
Yeah.
And Jordi Alba, left back, who I think Valencia, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Coming in and looking okay, but you know, that was this. But go back to the last couple of tournaments, left back was always considered. Defence was a problem, and left back was the problem. Capdevila played actually quite well in the World Cup finals.
I just always thought that Capdevila gave them a really solid attacking outlet. I think he's, you know, he had a really sweet left foot and you could, you know, when getting forward, he was always reliable at building a dynamic with whoever was playing in front of him, but also delivering really, really decent quality into the box. And obviously with Arbeloa on the right, not Ramos. I think they missed that sense of, reckless abandon.
Well, Ramos does a better job of timing his runs forward and taking the... Arbeloa seemed to occupy the space too early to me when he went forward, as opposed to Ramos takes a space when it's available and times his run into that space very well. Thought that was a little bit different. It changes the momentum of the game. So Arbeloa was kind of standing there waiting for the ball to come, while Ramos usually kind of allows the ball to lead him into that. So he's moving forward at that point. So that was a little thing they missed.
Interesting. That when the lineups were released, Fabio Capello didn't hide his strategies at all.
No.
Because he played Scotty Parker, Phil Jones and Frank Lampard as his three central midfielders. So if you're looking for any sort of bit of creativity, it's not really going to come from those three people.
A little bit of pace out wide with Walcott starting.
Yeah.
Milner, who did very little in the first 20-25 minutes but grew into the game,
would
be quite effective come the second half. And Darren Bent, I'm sorry, but I'm still not sold on Darren Bent as an international striker.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the England positives, and this is, I suppose, long term. The performance of Joleon Lescott, I thought, was outstanding. Scott Parker, I believe, got man of the match, which I think, you know, Parker was great, don't get me wrong. Lescott was marshalling, he was organising, and every time, his name was mentioned all the time. Oh, blocked by Lescott. Oh, Lescott gets his foot in the way.
But here's the problem, Owen. How often are England going to have to play like that? That's the issue, isn't it?
That's it.
We can't, you know, the five things we learned from England against Spain, one them, we learned nothing, really. We learned how England can approach Spain, but is that how England would approach Italy? Is that how England would approach Portugal or France or Germany? Maybe Germany.
Maybe Germany.
After the lessons from the last time. But it's just not, is it? It's a formula we've seen work before.
Yeah.
We've seen it work against Barcelona to an extent. You go back to the Chelsea performance a couple of years ago when Hiddink was in charge. Mm-hmm. We look at Switzerland. We look at the United States. We know what... And just the fact that Spain... Spain run it pretty tight at times. Mm-hmm. You know, that last World Cup, they lost to Switzerland in the first game. So they're always open to when they don't create... Or more to the point, they don't take their chances. Because Villa hit the post. Mm-hmm. He also went round the goalkeeper as well. And I thought he should have done a lot better with that.
Great opportunity.
And Fabregas was just... Three of them he missed.
Fabregas slipped through in that little right channel.
Yeah.
Shoot, put it across Joe Hart. And he looks for the cutback.
And he tries to cut back to Torres.
He should have put it high and... Like it wasn't on.
No,
like it
just, no.
And you know,
Villa would have thumped that.
Exactly. And yeah. you just have to go for it. And then you're after the game, you're England, we're playing anti-football.
But it's interesting as well because you could... I think it's relatively easy to see Spain running into that situation again at the European Championships and possibly going out.
It could happen. And also, I think the one of the things that comes into it, particularly with a story that's under the radar a little bit, maybe still in England, is that the John Terry at Chelsea... VS Boas thinking that Terry just doesn't have the pace for the way that he wants to play, which is that high line that we talked about before. And you know, you take the risk of the space in behind, but for that you need two centre backs who are quite pacey.
Yep.
Is this only a style of play that works for England with certain personnel playing in key positions? Yep. Would they have been able to play the same way with a John Terry playing, with a Rio playing, or is it now Jagielka was caught with a couple of runs that Villa made.
Villa made these kind of standard runs from left to right across.
Just kind of in front of the fullback and then weave in.
And that's the one who went around Hart and finished up hitting it in the side net. Exactly. It was a great chance. And there was a couple of chances. I think there was one in the first half as well he had which makes him... But Villa was the guy. If anybody was going to score, it was going to be Villa. But that's come back. The other thing that I picked up on, and I think this is what got me thinking of Pedro, and how much they missed him. There was at least three balls that were played from the right side, right across the front of the English penalty area, that came out the back with nobody in sight. They were getting no support from that left side, that left side of midfield. So I'd mentioned already about Dan Benn, and he did get up very well for that header.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I read a piece by Rafa Benitez just before the game on Saturday on his blog, and he'd suggested that if Spain, he's a little bit more precise than a lot of Spain, if they've got a problem as defence. He was pointing out that balls to the back post, particular problem for Spain. Now, kind of back postish, but Ben got up well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting as well that if anyone looks at Barcelona and spots a weakness, it's in the air from set pieces, from crosses in general.
Which, let's face it, if you're playing the kind of game that England played, that's what you look to, set pieces. It's one of the things Jurgen Klinsmann mentioned, that he wanted to get the United States away from relying on set pieces.
I don't think
you ever get away from... You shouldn't be ever getting away from relying on set pieces. Not relying
free,
on them.
It's a free chance on goal, right?
Yeah.
But one thing I wanted to talk about was when Danny Welbeck was introduced.
More direct, better link player. Now, it was late in the game. Team tiring.
But him against Gerard Piqué, there was one moment down that touchline.
Yeah.
Knocked that ball in front of him and he was gone.
Yeah.
And Piqué was sold. He had to check back because of lack of support. But it was just an interesting little snapshot. Yeah. Again, now.
And I guess, of course, there was no Wayne Rooney.
Obviously, he had made changes to the defence as well. And, you know, he ended up with Adam Johnson, you know, on the pitch with Kyle Walker on the right side of midfield. So it was,
that was a bit patchy by that time, wasn't it?
It was take from that what you will. But certainly, as I was thinking at the time, an interesting little assignment in watching a game and seeing this is how England did it, and they were successful in doing it. And now, you expected with England that the concentration would drop and there'd be that moment where somebody would lose a run, and there'd just be that pinpoint ball in, and they'd go, you know, it would be pegged back to 1-1.
And to be fair, maybe they did a few times, but they never got punished for it.
It didn't.
Because there was a few chances there in that last 10, 15 minutes.
There just wasn't the clinical finishing from Spain.
So I guess looking forward to this weekend, we've got MLS Cup Final, which we'll review next week. Mm-hmm. We have Manchester City playing Newcastle, big game there. And we have Liverpool-Chelsea. So one question, we put out a question, so we'll deal with this very quickly. A question that came in from Liverpool, from a reader of the blog and watcher of the Fox Soccer Report. And it's related to, if I can find it.
You're taking out your Swish iPhone.
No, this is the hand-me-down iPhone, because I only get my wife's hand-me-downs.
Okay.
I'm not techie savvy.
It looks a little bit more impressive than my piece of shit, as they affectionately refer to it.
It's okay, my piece of shit was there for a couple was up to, there till a couple of months ago. But the question was, your opinion regarding Chelsea versus Liverpool, Suarez versus Torres, if he plays, comparisons and who will come out on top? Well, one thing, we don't do predictions.
No.
But Suarez scored 4 on the weekend. You see them?
Pretty good goal. I don't like Suarez.
You don't?
I don't watch his
pretty
goals.
Good goals.
Torres
still struggling, isn't he?
Torres just looks like any other average striker. Nothing to his game that represents anything unique. Or I don't know, something that you want from a 50 million quid striker.
He's just he's kind of playing a little bit in a daze. If he was any other player and he hadn't cost 50 million, he wouldn't be any place close to a first team place.
To be honest, it's a bit sad. Because you know, you're looking at his body language.
Shevchenko. It's very Shevchenko like.
And didn't people get in trouble when they were making that comparison?
Am I going to get into trouble?
No, I think... he's not Shevchenko. He's not.
But I'm talking about the type of player, but the body language you feel sorry for him.
You do. And he's the guy who, you know, who'll forever be associated with that miss at Old Trafford.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, as much as he scored a great goal in that game, his Chelsea career so far can be summed up with that miss.
Yeah. Now, Suarez hasn't been exactly... potent in front of the goal either, has he?
No,
well, but for Uruguay.
It'll be interesting to see how Chelsea marshal Suarez. And to see, you know, that high line, if it continues. Suarez is a pacey guy, plenty of movement.
Bring in Luis?
I'd imagine so. But when you bring in Luis, maybe it's a little bit of a reckless change as well, because you're never sure.
Because Chelsea, you could see Liverpool potentially doing to Chelsea what Arsenal did to them, couldn't you?
A little bit.
You go look at that. This might actually be a very interesting game, because this might be actually a game that plays to Liverpool's strengths,
mm-hmm.
which is they've got some pace on the counter.
On both
flanks. They've got players that can pick out long passes.
Mm-hmm.
They've got players that can shoot from range.
They've got overlapping fullbacks.
Yeah, it could be very, very interesting. But that has to wait till next week. Mm-hmm. So on behalf of Ono Callahan and producer Luke Crawford, thank you for allowing us to be part of your day. Until the next time, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Soccer Report Extra Podcast. For more great soccer news, highlights, and analysis, watch the Fox Soccer Report every night at 10 p.m. Eastern on Fox Soccer and Fox Sports World Canada. And be sure to check out SoccerReportExtra.com daily for previews, opinions, and reviews. Music for this podcast provided by SoundJay.com.